What happens when a woman with passion and a love for her community challenges the Republican establishment? You get The Fight You Don't See. Meet Wendy Davis, a woman who dreamed of running for office since she was a teenager. In 2020, she went from Wendy Davis, PhD, to Wendy Davis, Democrat candidate for Utah House. Little did she know the labyrinth she'd have to navigate, from local media unwilling to cover her campaign and finding a way beyond the barricaded doors of politics, to bridging the partisan divide and figuring out how to campaign during a pandemic. And don't forget the usual sexism and misogyny that comes with politics. Learn how Wendy stood up to her own party while giving her Republican opponent a run for his money. She ended up having the closest race in all of Utah, just a mere 78 votes away from flipping her red district blue. I say we just jump on in. I picked up two main themes in your book. One, of course, sexism and politics. We'll get into that later on. But the other one was how you tried to bridge this gap between left and right and how difficult that is. People look at life in terms of your party. You're a Democrat. You talk about needing their vote. You weren't going to win if only Democrats elected you. But what I thought was kind of a little bit shocking was later on in the book, you talk about your Mormon faith and going to church. And I want to read this one little paragraph so people that listen to it know what I'm talking about. Sure. And you say, following Donald Trump's victory in the 2016 election, I reached a point where attending church became unbearable. The thought of sitting among neighbors who potentially supported Trump weighed heavily on me. In the depths of my mind, I found myself secretly wondering who among them had voted for him. This internal struggle became inescapable, dark hole that consumed me, leading me to make the difficult decision to take a break from church for a few months. In a candid conversation, I told my bishop that I couldn't teach Sunday school for a while because I was sure some of my students voted for Trump, and I needed time to reconcile that and move forward. So I was kind of wondering how, when you were out in the campaign trail and you expected people to kind of ignore that you were a Democrat and see the good parts about your campaign, how then you kind of did the same thing back towards Trump voters and you couldn't attend church with them. So how did you end up reconciling that, getting over that? Did you get over that?
Oh, sure. No, that's a great question. I think it's fascinating that that was interesting to you. I'm so glad that was interesting to you. That's one of my very favorite chapters. I really lay bare a lot of, parts that people don't always talk about, which is where their faith intersects with their secular beliefs and their political beliefs. And, you know, it's interesting. I think that we are much more alike than we are different. And I've had many friends who have been on the opposite side of the political spectrum than I have been. And more often than not, we agree on what the problems are. We agree on what the problems are. So, for example, I think we have a problem with the border. I think it's terribly problematic. I think we have a problem with childcare. I think we have a problem with healthcare. More often than not, most people that I communicate with, we agree on the problems. Where we differ is how we solution them, right? And so with respect to how do you say, I expect people to look at me as a whole person when I'm running and not look at my particular political proclivity. I don't like labels. If I could run on a ballot without a label and think that I could win, I would have done that. But the truth is that party identity is so strong. I mean, very rarely do unaffiliated or independent candidates make their way in the world and to any degree of success. So yes, I definitely wanted people to look at the whole me. I think where it became personal when you intersect your faith and your religious beliefs with politics is this. As a woman of faith who believes how I believe, it's interesting. I think we see the same problems, even people who disagree with me on at church, but we disagree about how to solve them. And where, to me, Donald Trump was an immoral person, and it went against everything I believed. I found that he was unkind, that he was unjust, that he was a bully, And to me, that was just counterintuitive to everything that I believed about goodness in people and my faith in Christ and my faith in God. So it was so hard for me to believe or understand how good people who believed what I believed, we could see the same problem before us and have very different opinions about, you know, whether this person was okay or not. That was really hard for me. So instead of speaking out, you know, I could have used my Sunday school platform to talk about that. And I chose not to. I was genuinely just befuddled by that. And also, you know, people's votes are private. I had to like sit with my feelings for a minute and say, you know, that person probably voted for him. And I love that person as my fellow congregant, as my neighbor, as someone that I'm with in Sunday school. And I have to let them own their decision. And I need to be with my feelings for a minute. And I just need a little space to kind of like breathe. And I just needed that. So, and of course, I'm like, people are entitled to believe what they want to believe. It was interesting when I did come back to teach. So it was a small break, like November, December, and I came back in January. And I still attended church. I'm like, I can't teach Sunday school right now. I can't stand up in front of people. And when I went to the Women's March in 2017, and a person that I care about very deeply, an older gentleman, he made a comment and said, you know, something about the veracity of the vote and not believing in the vote. I said, no. I've never questioned the veracity of the vote, but I feel so strongly that I want to exercise my First Amendment rights, and it is important to me to be there. It's not that I question the vote. And that was really about all that was ever said. And then with polite niceties, you just don't talk about it. It's like the things you don't talk about at Thanksgiving dinner. Right? So, yeah. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, I thought that was the most interesting chapter because, first of all, you don't hear of a lot of people converting to be a Mormon as adults. Normally, they're born into it. So you went into it fully with your own developed brain and mind and opinions, and you stayed with it so long. And then you got to the part where there was just that friction. Do you think that when you were out there campaigning and knocking on those doors, do you think they could maybe kind of tell you had this big issue with Trump to the point you thought he was immoral? Like, was that maybe a barrier? You thought that you were reaching?
Yeah. I don't think so at all. I think that people can hold multiple ideas in their mind at the same time. So there were a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump who voted for me. And there are other parts in the book where I write about the woman I met at the door, and we had both just seen the vice presidential debate, or the presidential debate, I can't remember which one it was. And she's like, there was a really clear winner. I'm like, yeah, there was. And it was really clear to me very quickly that we weren't talking about the same clear winner. and I'm one thing about me, like I'm pretty authentic. And I would tell people who I could tell were leaning a little bit more Republican, I would say, full disclosure, I'm running as a moderate Democrat. And I could see their wheels spinning a little bit. And that woman said, you know, state races are a little different. And in her mind, they were a little different. So I felt really authentic to who I was. There were other times I would knock on a door and voters would start talking in very disparaging terms about, you know, certain groups in the legislature and disparaging those of faith. And I would say, listen, full disclosure, I identify in that category as well. And you won't say bad things about that. And I mean, you're entitled to your opinion, but I just don't want to stand here and let you think I agree with you on that. Right. So, you know, religion very rarely came up at the door. It just, competitor and I were both of the same faith. It was kind of an equalizer, I think. And when it did come up at the door, it was in very rarely, and oftentimes it came up through social issues like abortion and women's reproductive rights. And it was a big signal to me when someone let out of the gate, you know, what are your opinions on abortion? I'm like, oh, we're going to lead with that, are we? Well, let me tell you what. Yeah. And I, you know, I'm astute enough to be able to you connect with people by meeting them where they are. So if I knew that that was likely because of a religious belief, I would be able to easily say something like, you know, I think that's between a woman and her maker and her family and her religious leader. That is not for me to decide. And oftentimes that was a satisfying answer for them, and never having to totally reveal exactly how I thought, but saying like, hey, this is what I think it is. And you just have to, different people need to receive messages in different ways.
Once you got them to kind of drop their guard a little bit when you said moderate Democrat and kind of put the abortion issue to the side, because that one's so divisive, what were those common issues that you were able to get that Trump voter to be like, I'm going to vote for her? What did you find was the crossing point that made them vote? Did you come across one or two solutions?
It's super easy. I really think that when we share common values, it's really easy to align on the values. And I was able to say, listen, I'm a mom and a grandma. What I want is my adult children to be able to afford a house in the county. I want my grandkids to have good education. I want people to have fair and equitable access to healthcare. And who can't be behind that? Their kids to be able to afford houses, their grandkids to be able to go to good schools, and for people to be taken care of. And when we can join on those common issues, that's the great unifier. We might disagree again about how to solve those problems, but when we can align on the values, I think that was the great equalizer. And also, I'd like to think I was a competent candidate who had some, you know, a little bit of experience, maybe not political experience, but other experience. And I think that they were able to see someone that they could get behind and say like, hey, this is a great candidate. I think that's the case when you look, and there were, you know, less than 5,000 registered Democrats in my district, and 9,671 people voted for me. Now, there are a lot of people who are unaffiliated, or sometimes they call themselves independent. That's not what they really mean. They're not part of the independent party. But people often don't register for a party. They like that sense of, I'm not affiliated with either party, right? But they still tend to vote certain ways, even though they say they're not part of a particular political party. I was not affiliated with a political party until I decided to run for office, and you have to declare. I voted for people, you know, and from all different kinds of parties. And so people like that badge. So even though there were, you know, a certain number of Democrats, or the big persuadable that we call them in campaigns are those voters who like to see themselves as independent, and they want to be convinced. They don't want to be labeled as something. They want to know your values. They want to know your issues. And being able to communicate that is really key to successfully connecting with voters.
Okay. I want to kind of touch on something you just mentioned, because it was a question I had. You talked about being a competent person running for office, which I very much think we lack today on both sides of the aisle. There's not a lot of intelligence going on. And so like when Biden ran in 2020 and he picked Kamala Harris as his vice president, and now we kind of see Trump maybe leaning towards a Kristi Noem, or McCain did Sarah Palin, I would say these are not the best and the brightest, especially when Biden, he could have chose Elizabeth Warren. She was a professor, highly intelligent. She was a workhorse for Biden's campaign. And he picked the woman who got the least likability rating, the least polling. Why is it that when it comes to putting a woman in authority position, a leadership position, the ultimate title of vice president, why do they kind of pick the dumbest women? I know that's kind of a brash term, but do you think it's still this latent sexism where let's put up a woman who will fulfill that self-fulfilling prophecy, women can't handle it, so then we can push him back another decade and tell him to shut up about wanting to be president? Because I don't ever think they pick the best. They flirt with this, oh, I'm going to get a woman. And it's like, that's not the best.
Well, it is politics, I think Vice President Harris is an intelligent woman. She was a senator. She's proven herself. What bothers me a lot, and in the 2016 election, I'll go back to that for a minute. I'm coming back to your question. I think we as women whether we're in politics or business or fill in the blank, we have things and attributes attached to us that are patently unfair. You know, she's shrill. I don't like her tone. I don't like her attitude. And whenever you get a woman in politics who ruffles feathers a little bit, we get these attributes associated to us. And my next door neighbors, who I adore, I was in 2016, one of them said, you know, Hillary Clinton, there's just something about her, the way she delivers, you know, her speech. And I said, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? In 2016, we're going to talk about, you know, probably unquestionably, maybe the most qualified presidential candidate in my lifetime. I'm stack her up against everybody in my lifetime. And we're talking about her voice? What? Wait, what? You know what I mean? So, and remember, Sarah Palin was the governor of Alaska. So the Alaskans advanced her to the ticket. She's a bit of a bulldog. She's a bit of a lightning rod, right? I don't know if she was a great running mate for the ultimate maverick and John McCain, who I like very much. Very polarizing. And it is what it is. but the answer to your question is, running mates are selected for political reasons. I also do think that they are selected. They are qualified. My personal hope was that Joe Biden would have selected Stacey Abrams to be his running mate. I think very highly of Stacey, having, you know, held a statewide office, intelligent woman. The things that she's done since her loss for governor have proven that again and again. You know, they make decisions for all kinds of reasons. I don't know if that was a satisfying answer.
That makes sense. That makes sense to me. Yeah, I get it. On that issue of tone, because you say in the book that you were told to watch your tone, what would be your advice? Because you've had a really successful career. You know, you got a PhD, you ran for office. How should women today respond to that when they're told that? Should they change their tone just to kind of play the game and go along? Should they tell them to their face, like, I'm not doing that, that's sexist, or ignore it? How do you deal with that without putting yourself in that category of, I just do what men tell me to?
I've been told my whole life to watch my tone. I can be a little bit sassy, or as my dad would have said, a sassy broad, right? And you know, that's just part of who I am. I don't know that a man is ever told to watch his tone or watch how he says something or watch that. And you know, when that has been said to me directly or indirectly, my retort is usually like, it's not my intention to make you feel comfortable with my tone, but the content of what I have to say is most important. And that's what I'm challenging you to consider. And yeah, maybe I have a tone in your eyes. That's my style. That's part of my personality. And I am who I am. And I'm not really interested in changing who I am to make you feel more comfortable or to, you know, meet the needs a little bit better. And, you know, I talk about tone in the context in the book of having been in a meeting with a lot of other candidates in a training and been a little bit aggressive in my questioning and challenging people who were experts, also considering myself an expert of my own campaign in my own district. And there's usually a subtext when someone talks about your tone or your attitude. What they usually mean, I found, is we don't like the way you're challenging what we have to say. We don't like the approach. We don't agree with you. And instead of saying what it is directly, I really think that tone is an easy straw man argument.
Okay, just easy way to shut you down without engaging on the content. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you told them like their numbers were wrong. Mm-hmm. They weren't adding up the way that you thought. Did jaws drop in the room full of men when you questioned that? Did heads explode?
No, usually it was a small room of friendlies, other candidates. And, you know, most people just got silent and didn't say too much. And, you know, it also challenging someone in a public setting puts them on the defensive. And I absolutely recognize that. And it wasn't in the spirit of like, hey, you got it wrong. It was more in the spirit of like, I ran these numbers. That's not what I got. So if you could share with me your methodology, maybe we could share notes and we could see where the comparison is. Maybe I got something wrong, right? And instead of that, it was, yeah, you don't need to know where we got our numbers. Our numbers are right. It's a proprietary algorithm. I'm not going to tell you that. And so suddenly you have an imperfect power structure. People who have more information and know the process have more power over you. And when you control the information and to tell someone like, I'm not going to tell you how I got those numbers, you're on a need to know basis. Well, actually, no, I'm a candidate. I need to know because I need to factor that into my own calculus of how I plan to win. If I got something wrong, I'd like to know. And if I have other information that I could share with you, maybe we could work together. So yeah, but that's the key takeaway there is it's the power structure of knowing more or thinking you know more than someone else and using that as power over them. That's something that I wrote about quite a bit in the book. I hope that came through.
Do you think if you were a man and you had questioned them, though, the response would have been the same?
I think it might have been similar, actually. Quite frankly, I don't know that that was like just because I'm a woman. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to say, listen, I have a PhD in political science. Maybe people don't know what political scientists do, but as someone who studied American politics, you study institutions, you study process, and you study voting behavior or political behavior. So I consider myself somewhat of an expert in this. It's not like I have an uninformed opinion. And I throw out the PhD very rarely, but I'm trying to create a more level power structure. You think you have all this data. I counter with, I'm trying to level the playing field with my knowledge, right? And I feel like I get summarily dismissed every time. I don't know if it's because people who run political campaigns or experts think that the academic knowledge is not as relevant as their practical application of the knowledge. But I feel dismissed quite a bit.
It sounded like it in your book. Yeah, I'd have been pulling my hair out if I was having to deal with some of the stuff you had to when you're already, I mean, running for office is already challenging enough without kind of your own party pushing against you. What I really enjoyed also, you talked about there being barricaded doors and how it's not really meant for regular people to run for office. How would you change that? Because politicians aren't going to impose term limits and change campaign finance. They regulate themselves. What do we do to get more regular people in there? Because when you're at a college, for instance, like I did some internships, they're unpaid. You have to be willing to afford that. You have to be able to afford these donor dinners to network and rub elbows. It isn't meant for normies. How do you see we can change that? Because if not, the elite will always rule.
Absolutely. You know, I pride myself in having been a normie who ran. Yeah, I might have an advanced education, but I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a land developer. I'm not like a prominent person in the community. But I was like, listen, I really think I can do this well, and I want to serve my community. And so how I think we change that, honestly, is demystifying what it is to run for office. And as you read in the book in the last chapter, I consider myself a candidate advocate. And if I can help demystify everything about like, hey, what's a yard sign cost? Should I be focused on events? Should I be focused on this? And I'm happy to take a call from and I do weekly take a call from a candidate asking a question. And recently I met with a candidate and her campaign. And I'm like, let me tell you the difference between political spectacle and what you need to be doing. And again, the people who have the knowledge have the power. And I don't even mean like political power, but they have a leg up. And, you know, we've done great things in my state. There have been lots of fantastic trainings for women, introducing them to current politicians and former politicians. at all levels of the ballot, I think that's helpful when you see someone like you. But I really think a lot of it is making a little bit of space for people who are like, hey, I want to do this. Maybe you're a rage candidate. Maybe somebody in your family died of cancer and you're angry at the system and that motivates you. Maybe something happened to your kid in school. Maybe you have a child who is disabled and you're a disabilities advocate and you are just so fired up that you want to do this. Then let's provide training mechanisms, whether that's through formal institutions like the party, or through things like, you know, I'm part of an organization, the Women's Democratic Club of Utah. There's other organizations in my state that do this, but I genuinely think that's part of the issue. I'm working on a training soon. I've been invited to a training where an organization is trying to encourage small business owners to run for office. Beautiful. Love it. Our small business owners have such a vested interest in taxation and how things are aligned with respect to property and the roads that service their businesses and are there safe communities so that people can come to their business. Like, let's get more people involved, and they don't have to be political elites. We need more moms. We need more grandmas. We need more people who are my neighbors involved in politics. And it doesn't have to be some, you know, you don't have to have an elite degree or have worked at a top business to be in politics. I mean, the founding fathers, going back to that, they were all really young and they were ship merchants, and most of them were normal guys. I mean, there were some plantation owners in there. That's a little bad, but, you know, for the most part, they were just people who were like, hey, I think I can do this. They were lawyers and stuff. I don't want to act like they weren't political elites, but we need more normal people doing it and just demystifying that process for them.
Okay. For people that are listening and maybe thinking, okay, I kind of want to run for office. If they called you up on the phone to get advice and asked you, what would you do differently next time from your last campaign? Like, did you kind of debrief, take a look at it from a macro view? What would you change?
Absolutely. You know, this is going to sound so ironic as a woman who has a degree in political science. My mantra was, it only matters what the voters think. And I really missed that I needed to play the political game. And I know that sounds so ironic, but there are multiple fronts that you're working. And you know, you need to raise money. You need to play well with donors. You need to play well with current elected politicians. They have a tremendous ability to support you or not support you. And you need to play well with the party, or even if it's not play well, at least come to a tacit understanding that you'll stay out of each other's way. And so I feel like my focus was correct. My sole focus was on the voters. Elected officials don't vote for me. Donors don't vote for me. Yard signs don't vote for me. But if I had to do it all over again, socializing the idea more with those people who had influence and at least letting them know a little bit about who I was. As you read in the book, I showed up. I'm like, hey, I'm here. I'm doing this. And they're like, who are you? I'm like, you don't know me. I want to do this since I was 14. I'm like, I'm ready. They're like, no, wait, who are you? And I'm like, no, really, I'm ready. And so that was really my big miss was not realizing that those local political structures mattered as much as they did. Now, remember, if you look at the state of Utah website, it says that my race was 50-50, literally 50% to 50%. That's how close my race was. This was not a landslide loss. When I broke it down, I think I had 32 or 34 precincts. It would have been the difference of 3 people in each precinct voting for me. When you break it down that way, it's heartbreaking. And if I could turn back time, I now know where I'd focus just a little bit more time to get those less than 100 votes that I needed. But in the big scheme of things, you have to play into the political spectacle. You have to play into the political game. And then at some point in time, toss all that aside and come like May or June, all you care about is the voters. knocking on their doors, getting in front of them. They are the ones who will actually vote for you.
I also know you talked about how your opponent was in the media, but you couldn't get coverage. Do you think maybe you should have focused more on getting more media attention? Or do you think they just weren't going to cover you anyway because you were the challenger? Was it kind of like a losing battle? So just ignore. When do you want to take into consideration the media, or when should you write them off?
I think that the media doesn't focus enough on local races. It's not exciting. And I ran in a presidential race a year, right? So all the focus was on the two presidential candidates. I also had a very contentious congressional race in my district where, I mean, even my granddaughter at the time was like, she's like, oh, well, you know, so-and-so took a flight to France on taxpayer money, but this guy does the other thing. I'm like, you're 8. How do you know this? She's like, I see it on TV all the time. Like when an 8-year-old so inundated with information that she can tell you what politicians are doing, that's too much. And there's way too much political spectacle around that. I just think that we would be, you know, oftentimes I'll go to a Meet the Candidates night that's moderated by a local news personality and 20 people show up. I actually think that these races matter more, whether it's a statewide house race, a school board race. When you think about it, the people at your school board, how much their decisions impact you in your neighborhood directly is far more direct than anything that happens in Washington, D.C. My school board has the ability to raise taxes, right? My school board has the ability to do X, Y, Z. Like 60% of my property tax goes to my local school board. That's a lot of power and influence. Am I seeing any school board candidates on the news? Not unless they do something crazy and salacious, right? So I think part of it is that. The other thing is, it was COVID. It was the middle of COVID. It was a hard time to run. There weren't events. There wasn't a lot of media happening in general. And right before I got media attention when my race was the closest in all of Utah. And right before the final canvass, when the board certifies the vote, on that day, there was a story done on myself and my competitor by a local news personality. And off camera and kind of as an aside, and I knew I was going to lose. It was a done deal. It was all done by the counting, and the counting was done. And she kind of looked off camera and said, she said, we really missed these local races. We really did all of you a disservice by not focusing on them. And it wasn't an apology. It was more of like, what can I do better, different next time? And, you know, there are some amazing people that are running. Focus on them a little bit. Talk about the issues that they're elevating. I just, my whole life, I haven't seen local candidates get a lot of airtime. But I think that needs to change. I think that needs to change. I don't know if that's helpful. The story that I share about the media was just so silly. Like, stop making up stories. Like, they're a non-story story. Like, you know what I mean?
They're so dumb. I thought, I can't imagine wasting time to put that on air. Yes,
I mean, and there are other ways that you can cover candidates. Like in COVID, we could have covered who's campaigning on COVID. I mean, I write about how torn I was about whether to knock doors or not in the middle of, I mean, it's, now COVID's 4 years ago, and our memory, it's hard to remember. Like, we were all wearing masks. We weren't going anywhere. And the thought of like knocking on someone's door in the middle of a global pandemic gave a lot of people angst. You could have done a story on that and done it, you know, on women or men. It doesn't matter. Party. Like, how can you talk about local candidates in a way that's not so partisan? But like, what are they doing? What is a unit? There are ways to do this. It's just, you know how the media is. It's a lot of it is a couple of news bites and a little bit of fluff. Sorry, media. I've got friends in the media, but it's not deep insight.
I worked at Fox News for 3 years, right in the middle of the pandemic. And my opinion of media, it's not the best and brightest. Let's put it that way. If it bleeds, it leads, and they'll put anything salacious, and you're not going to learn anything.
Well, I was just going to say, the one point in the book that was so poignant to me was election night, when I turn on my local 10 o'clock news and they're showing the election results and they talk about three close races and mine, which is the closest, still wasn't mentioned. And my husband turned to me and he said, he's not going to say your name, is he? And I'm like, no, they're not. They're just not going to say my name. And it's just this feeling of like, what do I have to do to get someone to take me seriously? And the media has more leverage than they think they have. Was him mentioning my name going to change the vote? Nope, the votes were already in. But the fact that it wasn't even recognized and I had the closest race, actually I was winning by the largest margin at that point in time over any incumbent. That was disappointing.
It goes to show you that it feels like they were kind of against you from the very outset. I mean, saying your name on election night, like you said, wasn't going to change anything. But if they were that adamant against you.
You know, I don't think anybody was against me. I feel like they really liked my incumbent. And there's a difference there, right? So it wasn't so much that people were quote unquote against me. They really liked him. And I remember there was one tweet by a state senator when it looked like the incumbent was going to lose. And there was a tweet posted about like, it's going to be a huge loss to lose this person. They're just a great person. They're this, they're that, and they're other. And a whole bunch of people jumped in, you don't respond to that. And people jumped in and said, she's going to be just fine. You think she can't pick up the same issues? You think she's like it's going to be fine. And I think that kind of embodies the sentiment. It wasn't that people were against me. It's that they really liked this other person. I think that's really what it was.
It's kind of like a popularity contest more. It seems very high school. We're just going to vote for the guy we know, the guy we like.
The guy we know and the guy we like. And he is a good person. He is a good person. And that was, as I write about, that was one of my biggest challenges. It's easier to have a nemesis that is like, oh, that guy did this, or that woman did this, that, oh, like, can you believe it? And it was like, all right. Okay, I agree with that. I agree with that. All right. Okay. I just don't think we, in a state where, you know, we're much more, you know, we're probably like 35% Democratic, to have a super majority in the legislature. So my goal was to try and provide a balanced voice in a district that I know was winnable. Not necessarily like, hey, he's the worst guy ever. He needs to get out of here. It wasn't about that. But voters were able to see that, right? They were able to see that, yep, they're two great candidates. And I think that's why the vote was pretty much how it was.
Do you think you'll run again? After everything you went through, would you want to do it again? Because you got so close.
I got so close. And, you know, it was interesting. I shouldn't do this. I have a bad habit of like looking at Twitter right before I go to bed, or X, whatever you want to call it. Somebody had posted a really kind post about my book. Somebody who had run for Congress and lost. And had a few more people following him on X than I do. And a state senator jumped on it and just wrote some really snarky comments like, it's funny when somebody writes a tell-all book, you have to look up who they are because they basically don't matter anymore. And like, it brought up a bunch of feelings for just a minute of like, oh, do I want to expose myself to that again? You know, like when you're a candidate, you just can't respond to a lot of things. And, you know, every day that I get further and further away from all of that, I wonder if I can't make more of a difference doing things like writing this book and giving my story and giving an insider perspective and encouraging women to run for politics, encouraging the normies to run. I'm not beholden to a party. I'm not beholden to leadership in the House. I'm not beholden to voters. I'm not beholden to donors. I don't have to account to anybody but myself and my family about who I am. And that gives me, when we talk about power structures, that puts me in an interesting position to influence in a way that can be helpful and supportive. Would I love to be in the legislature? Here's the deal. You know, now that I know a little bit more, it's kind of like choosing your coworkers. And I'm like, do I want to work with those people? You know, you don't think about it that way. Like, would you want to go work for a toxic company where you know your voice is never going to matter, where they're going to hold your bills in committee because they can? It's like, would I subject myself to that? Right? And so I don't know the answer to your question. I leave that door open. I hope that you can see I have a profound love for my community. I consider myself patriotic. I love my country. I believe in democratic principles. I just need to make sure that I can have influence. And I don't want to put myself in a place where I can't have influence. So will I run again? TBD. Right now, the answer is no. Right now, the answer is no. Is no. I feel really great about where I am in my station in life, but I do want to continue to be engaged. And we'll see. I need to leave that door open.
That's the sad thing about politics. It's so nasty that it almost automatically cuts out good people from wanting to jump on board. Decent people that don't want their life just like ripped in half. There's a quote, fools rush in where angels for to tread. And I feel like that pretty much is what politics is. The worst of the worst, because what normal person would want to go through that?
And I appreciate you saying that. And I have to tell you, I thought a long time before I wrote this book. I sat on it for a couple of years. I needed to process it. I'm like, does my story matter? Is anybody going to be interested? I'm just me. I'm a woman who lost a race, who had a close race, ran as a Democrat in Utah. People might have thought that was crazy. But I'm like, you know what? There are not enough firsthand political narratives written, because you either get in office and you're busy, or you lose and you're so done with the whole thing. And, you know, after about year one and a half, I started socializing, like, I need to write this book. I need to. And I need to for myself. I wanted to tell my story. I wanted to immortalize that. But also, if this gives people just a little bit, people's journeys to politics will be very different. Their experience will be different. But I call it the fight you don't see for a reason, because I really believe that. I think that running for office, especially depending on what level, there are a million fights you don't see. And you're putting up your Wonder Woman bracelets every day and you're stuffing it down. And that's why I wrote the book. That's why I wrote the book, is just to say, like, hey, I did this. You can do it, but you need to know it's going to be pretty rough. And here's some things you never thought about.
No, I thought it was a good take to have on a book, because I feel like we always hear about the winners and we assume that there's no story to be told on the other side. And you put the Republicans on alert. I mean, to make the race that close, they're going to have to kind of rethink what they do from now. They might moderate their positions a little bit if they don't want to be challenged by another Democrat. No, I thought it was really good. I've always wanted to run for office, so.
You should.
I want to. I don't know. I'm always like, well, I got to live somewhere long enough. And I think, like you said in the book, you multiple times, oh, now's not the time. Now's not the time. But really, is any time the time, I guess? Do you wish you had jumped in earlier?
What I wish I had done, if I had a time machine and turned back time, I wish I had run in 2018. So what I would have done is be what we call an affiliate candidate. I would have put my name on the ballot and maybe done a little bit of campaigning just to get my name out there. But that went against everything that I believe, because I throw my heart into everything. I don't do anything halfway. And so, you know, I was really close to committing in 2018. And the reason I didn't is because I was 8-9 years into my PhD program, heads down on my dissertation. And that was really, really hard. And listen, when you're writing your dissertation, I don't know if people know this, but you continue to pay tuition. Like, you pay tuition the whole time. Like, I was working on my dissertation for 3 years and, you know, had to pay the university. I'm like, I'm done paying tuition. I need to get this thing done. And I knew that in my heart that I couldn't divide my time. And it just went against my moral fiber to do anything halfway. But in retrospect, 2018 would have helped a little bit. I would have had a little bit more name recognition. And I think that would have propelled me just enough in 2020 to be helpful. That's definitely a regret that I have. I do think had I tried to run any time that I mentioned, that it would have impacted my PhD pursuits, which were really important to me. And remember, I had a full-time job. I traveled every week. I'm a mom. And I was thinking of running for office and I'm getting a PhD. Like, what? Wait, what? Like, I could do two things really well. I just couldn't do the third really well. And that's why I'm like, I got to get this dissertation done and put the stamp on that. And I handed it in my really solid final draft. And like days later, I'm like, all right, I'm here. I'm ready. What's next? Right. But there is never a good time. You will never be ready. 100%. You don't know what you don't know. I really feel like if people just jump in and they're committed, the rest of it kind of works out. I met a woman who was like deer in the headlights. She's like, I'm running for this house surgery. I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm like, you're going to be okay. You are going to be okay. You don't need to know what you're doing. And just do what you're going to do. And you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine. You should totally do it. Call me when you want to and we'll have long conversations.
I'll take you up on that because I'm going to do it one day. So you might be getting a call from me. One thing that kind of holds me back, and I'm assuming maybe other people, is the fundraising aspect. I would just rather die than ask somebody to donate to a campaign. I don't even like, when I was in college, I hated asking for a recommendation letter. I just don't want to imposition anybody. But in your book, you talked about how they set these goals for you. And then you were kind of like, nah, I'm not doing this. I can set my own goals. And I like that because I've often thought if I saved enough money, I could just finance it myself and cut that out. Do you think that hindered you by not aggressively focusing on fundraising? Or do you think that made it, you have a better, more winning campaign because people recognized you weren't in it for the cash and the donations? And
yeah. So a couple of things. I didn't lose my race because I didn't have enough money. I had enough money to run my race in the end. And here's the thing. People want to support you. That's what I found out. People want to be asked. They want to support you. And so at first I was like, what's the strength of the relationship? Have I talked to them in a couple of years? Will it be weird? Will it be awkward? I'm like, I'm asking everybody. I'm just asking everybody. And you know, my friends and family came through for me in a big way, and it just made my heart so happy. And you know, kids that I knew from when I was in elementary school, and my college friends and coworkers and neighbors and this and that and family, and every small dollar donation that I got in buoyed me up, right? And so then I focused on what I knew best, and I went after union endorsements. You saw that a significant portion or a quantifiable portion of my donations came from unions, and I worked it. I got some private donations, and here's the thing: money starts to grow. It's like you need a little to get going, but you can run a campaign on a small budget. But yeah, I did. I was still the largest donor to my campaign, and I'm proud of that. And also remember, it was COVID. I wasn't going to baseball games. I wasn't going to concerts. I wasn't going to the symphony. I wasn't doing all the things that I would normally spend my disposable income on. I'm like, I can bank $1,000 a month toward the campaign because I'm not doing anything else but eating, living, and breathing. And so that was important to me. I wanted to have skin in the game as it is, you know. But what somebody should never do is go into debt, personal debt, to run a campaign. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. If you only raise $5,000, get your door hangers, get your yard signs, do a mailer, and that's what you got. Don't ever go into debt. Don't put it on credit cards. Don't do like that. No, don't do that. Money will come, and it will come in ways that are unexpected. I share the story about my aunt, my oldest aunt, my dad's oldest sister, who I'm quite frankly not very close to. We don't live in the same state. She's significantly older than my dad. And I just wrote her a letter and she sent me $1,000 check. And I cried that day. And to me, it was just such a representation of our family. And I knew she was doing it because she was my aunt. I knew she was proud of me. I knew she knew my dad would have been proud of me. And that touched me. You just never know who is wanting to support you. So don't be afraid to ask. I know it's awkward and weird and it feels icky, but, and just be comfortable with the no. I had a lot of people say, you know what, times are tough right now. I can support you in other ways, but I just can't afford to. And I'm like, thank you for your support. It means so much to me. And being gracious with whatever the answer is, you know, that's it. You just have to be more comfortable in that. Those are things we can practice, though. You can learn, you can practice that.
So it's not as scary as I think. Okay.
It's intimidating. No one should ever let that stop them. They shouldn't let that stop them. I do think that that is a huge barrier, because you think, if someone says, oh, you got to raise $100,000 for a state race. Wait, what? I haven't saved $100,000 in my life, anything, right? Like, just, it's one donation at a time. It's one phone call at a time. It's just, you scale to what you've got. Don't let that stop you.
I'll keep that in my noodle. I'll keep ruminate on that. I will ask you a few more questions about running for office since I got you here. I was wondering, what's a skill that someone could acquire through like other jobs or their life, or maybe even as a teenager, that isn't necessarily you would think is a political skill, but is something that's very effective to have when you're running for office?
I talk about my communication skills. I think that is important. Public speaking is something that a lot of people fear. It can be learned. It can be practiced. And you should practice it again and again, especially as you're a candidate. And the other thing that people might not think about is you just need to be highly organized and get through tasks, or get somebody on your team who can keep you organized. And it's just like any other job. It's responsiveness. It's prioritizing the most important things. You'll have 40 sticky notes. You just have to put them in order. Today I have to do this. Tomorrow I have to do that. And it's really about prioritization and focus. And I know that those are soft skills. You know, everything else you can either have people help you with. Like, I'm not particularly great at marketing emails. My campaign manager was great at that. I write about logo design. No one should ever let me design a logo. So, you know where your skills extend to. When you need help with that, get people to help you. You can get coaches to help you with speaking. And then when you need to, hire people who are better than you to help you with your marketing or your logo or what have you. And I think, I don't know if that's helpful, but those are a couple of skills that I think people wouldn't think like, oh, I can do that. You don't have to, you know, be the best writer or the best whatever, but communication is clearly one of the strongest attributes, I think, that's helpful.
Is there a specific like book or resource you would maybe tell somebody you should read this as a primer to like improve your communication skills, or maybe TED Talk? Sometimes people have a favorite thing.
You know, what's really fascinating is if you just start listening a little bit to what some elected politicians say, you'll start to get some cues. And there are techniques, and some politicians are really astute at this. Like, if you ask me a question that I don't want to answer, like, let's say you ask me about, I don't know, what I think about climate change, because I'm not a climate change expert. That's really fascinating I really think climate change is important. I think the Great Salt Lake is really important. Let me tell you what I think is really important. I think that having affordable housing, education, and equity for all in healthcare is really, really important. It's a technique, and you can watch it on videos again and again, and just reframing and redirecting. So you acknowledge, and then you move on to your point. And that's what you're constantly trying to do, is get people to move to what you're trying. You don't, when you engage, you don't have to let somebody drag you down their rabbit hole. You don't. You can be like, I see your rabbit hole, and I'm moving over here. Right? And so, but those be learned. Those things can be learned. And now that I mentioned it, if you start watching interviews of people, you'll start to say, oh, I see what Wendy meant now. So I wouldn't say that there's a book. I would say like observation, but clearly, I mean, there, I have a friend who's a political consultant, and she'll do like media prep. Here's the kind of questions, here's how you're going to redirect. Let's practice this phrase. Let's practice saying it again and again. You'll practice your door approach. You'll have it down, be able to say it in your sleep. And then every once in a while, someone will say like, what do you think about nuclear reactors in the West Desert? I'm like, what do I? And you know, flip it back. Well, what do you think? Tell me what you think. I'd like to hear what you think. There are techniques that you can learn, but I think less than reading a book, it's more about observing and then actually getting a coach or working with people to practice. It doesn't have to be like a fancy coach.
Okay. Before we kind of get off the questions on running for office, want to throw a kind of a fun one in here. If you, since you've ran for office, you've written a book, if you were advising the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign, what would you say to each of them is their biggest mistake they're making right now on the campaign that you see, since you were in the nitty gritty, you were doing all of it, you were wearing all the hats, they're just the candidates. What would you say their biggest mistake is right now?
Well, that's a big one. I'll start with Joe Biden. I support the president. I like the president. I actually think history will treat him very well. He's actually been a good president. When we look at economic policy, there have been some big misses. I think he has an image problem and not letting the Trump campaign control the narrative. I think the age question is the biggest one, and constantly putting in question his competency. And he's competent. He's smart. He is in his 80s. People are living longer. People are well productive into their 80s. But also, you know, I always go back to the 92 election. I go into the way back machine when we succeeded in Iraq, right, with the invasion of Iraq and driving Saddam Hussein out of Iraq. We stopped short of going all the way to Baghdad and shutting him down then. But we won the war, but Bush lost the election, Bush 41. Why? It was on economic issues. The kitchen table issues matter most to people. How many potato chips are in their overinflated bag, right? What are the prices of gas? Do people feel secure? Are they able to buy homes? Are the interest rates such that they feel secure? Can they buy their kids their new school clothes? Like, those things matter. Do they feel safe, protected, like they're prospering? And I do think that the Biden administration has done great job in many of those areas, but aren't showcasing enough. Don't let someone else control the narrative, right? I think that that's the biggest thing. I have a lot of friends, very friends from the Midwest, very reasonable friends who are like, listen, I'm going to vote for him. I don't really want to, but I'm going to vote for him. And you know, that's never the position you want to be in. You don't want to be somebody's choice because the other guy is so much worse. You want to be someone's choice because you've demonstrated that your policy is good, and their policy is good. I just don't feel like they've done enough to amplify that. It's not sticking somehow. I do appreciate that he's come out swinging a little bit more, acknowledging I'm 82. I'm not a young guy. I get it. Can't do that. With Trump, I don't know what to say, quite frankly. He's got so many issues, so many problems. He's doubling down on the rhetoric that's always worked for him. I don't know how many people are still on board with that. Just as soon as I think rational people would never be on board with that rhetoric, I'm always shocked that people are. The fact that he lost in the last election and lost by a lot, right? We can talk about votes in certain states, or we can talk about Georgia, or we can talk about what have you, but he lost the popular vote. He lost in the Electoral College. It wasn't even in question. Listen, if you want to get some people back to vote for you, you got to figure out what's alienating those voters who didn't vote for you in 2020, right? I don't think he cares. I don't think he cares. I'm always trying to figure out his end game. I'm like, why don't you just go to Mar-a-Lago and like take a dip in your pool? Like, I don't understand. Like, I'm having a really hard time figuring out like what his end game is. Yeah. So he's got an image problem all over the place. The lawsuits aren't going away. The lawsuits are valid. I haven't looked at the news today. The fact that he couldn't get a bond to pay for the $400+ million settlement that he has to pay. I don't think he cares two bits about anything I have to say, but the voters care. And it would be about how are you going to attract those potentially crossover voters.
Okay, kind of left field question here. just your expertise as a political scientist, do you think RFK Jr. will have much of an impact in this election to sway it or take it from one of the candidates? Do you think he'll end up maybe being a Ross Perot, or do you think he's going to dwindle by the time November comes around? I know this has nothing to do with your book. I just find it fascinating. I wanted to ask your opinion.
92, good reference to Ross Perot, H. Ross Perot. And I was a young person in 92, and all my friends were like, down with the establishment. I'm not voting for either of those two, you know. We know what happened. Maybe Ross Perot got one electoral college vote. And here's the thing. The thing about third party candidates is that they do pull votes. The question will be, where do they pull votes from? That's always like the loose cannon, unpredictable. I do think that people are clamoring for a different choice. And RFK is interesting, right? So from what I understand, the Kennedy family is like, he's the cousin we don't want to talk about. We don't have anything to do with him. So he's definitely not upholding their democratic traditions, right? So he's clearly not a Democrat. He's on the ballot in Utah. There was a controversy. There was a lawsuit filed. So he's on the ballot in Utah. I have heard in very anecdotal ways, like people that I've seen at events, they're like, you know, I think I'm going to vote for him. I'm like, wait, what? I'm like, okay. And then I didn't think he was a factor. My friend who lives in New Jersey, she's got a high school senior who just turned 18. She's like, I know you don't want to hear this, but all my son and all of his friends are voting for RFK. I'm like, wait, why? She's like, he's got this following on TikTok, and he's like affecting the young people. I'm like, the young people? Like, what are you talking about? And she told me why, that they want somebody younger, that they want somebody who like is anti-disestablishment. They want somebody different. And I'm like, and he's your guy? But like, he's one of the only people who's right at the top, right? So with respect to third party candidates, I will say this and scream it from the mountaintops, and people might get angry with me because they want to inject change into a very controlling two-party system. Third party candidates never win. They do have the ability to make impact. But if I go back to 2016 in Utah, when Evan McMullen ran for president, okay, ran against Donald Trump for president. There's always like 40 people on the ballot running for president. And in Utah, where we were conflicted, people who were never going to vote for Hillary weren't going to vote for Hillary. But there were people who I think were of the predominant faith, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who are like, I just can't vote for this Trump guy. I can't do it. I cannot reconcile this. Evan McMullen came in third. Donald Trump, then Hillary Clinton, and Evan McMullen. So even though there was a bit of a movement, it's still not enough to pull something, right? Even in a state like Utah, where, you know, Evan got, I don't know what percentage he got, but not enough for Donald Trump not to. Donald Trump didn't even get 50% in Utah in 2016. So it might be enough to pull some votes from a candidate, but it won't be enough to win anywhere. Could be a disruptor, but I don't think anything that would make it significant. Do I think that we should have third party candidates? I do, because usually they are issue-based candidates. Remember what H. Ross Perot was? Do you remember what he was in favor of? Like the standardization of the tax form, like make it one page, right? And people can get behind a simple idea. Green Party, you know, what do they stand for? Ralph Nader, what did he run for? Like, you know people because of their issues. And that's often what a third party candidate does, is they're running on an issue to elevate their voice for that particular platform. So that was a really long-winded answer.
No, that's good. You said you don't think third party candidates will win. Do you think though, as a candidate, it would be easier because you don't have such an overbearing party breathing down your neck, kind of like you did? Like, even though you have the resources that the big party has, you have the freedom and agility to do as you see fit?
I wish that two things could be true at once. I wish that you could run as an unaffiliated candidate and that people would still vote for you as a person. The truth of the matter is that party affiliation is so strong, no matter how much we want to fight it, it's such an indicator. I mean, when I was meeting with voters, a couple of things would happen. Oh, you're a Democrat. I only vote for Democrats. I got you. No worries. You don't want to know about me? Nope. I don't want to know about you. I just want to know you're a Democrat. That was not satisfying to me at all. Equally dissatisfying was like, oh, you're a Democrat. I'm never going to vote for you because you're a Democrat, because you're a Democrat, because you're a Democrat. So those party affiliations mean something. If people don't know a candidate, they're going to be like, oh, I always vote for the Democrat, or I have always voted against the Democrat. And so I just cannot emphasize enough how important that party ID is. There are places like Alaska where they have broken some of those trends and advanced some unaffiliated candidates. There's a movement in Utah right now to advance unaffiliated candidates. The somewhat philosophy behind that is if you're faced with a horrible Republican and someone who's unaffiliated, who's a great candidate, the unaffiliated good person with sound policies and ideas will be able to defeat this Republican candidate because they're so horrid, right? I'm going to bring back Evan McMullen into the conversation. In 2022, the Democrats did not advance a Senate candidate to the ballot, but our Senator Mike Lee was up for re-election, and Evan McMullen ran as an independent. He still didn't win. He got closer than anybody has ever. He questionably could have gotten closer than even a Democrat could have gotten. That party ID is so important. We'd like to think it doesn't matter, but it does. It really still does. So to answer your question, in a world where people only looked at, there were no parties and we only looked at candidates and we had to research them and look at their goodness as a potential policymaker, and nobody had party affiliations, that would be a great equalizer. And I think that that would matter. I, Wendy, would never run unaffiliated unless I were making a statement about something, right? In case I were trying to stick it to the man for some reason. But it wouldn't be a serious decision for me.
Okay. Well, I'm going to kind of get away from the electoral stuff. I got a few questions I want to boomerang back to about sexism in politics, because I find that very interesting. I feel like I've run into some of that on my way. I think what all women can relate to is the part in your book where you talk about losing weight. I think every woman in her life has tried to lose a few pounds, but you felt like you needed to do it to even be able to run for office. And I find that so jarring when you have someone like Chris Christie who runs for office and nobody brings up his weight. Why is it that people feel like for a woman, she needs to be thinner or in her prime, as sometimes they say, but we don't say that about men? Because the thing about weight is, if you think it's going to affect your ability to do the job or it's unhealthy, that's true for both men and women. You're not going to escape that. Why does that still exist in 2024?
I do think people have commented on Chris Christie's weight, not to the extent that they would if he were a woman. And Bill Clinton took some knocks, if you remember him having like a heart attack with Big Mac and like then totally going vegan. And people comment about Donald Trump's weight as well. I think it's a cheap blow, no matter who it is, but unquestionably women and their appearance are attacked even more. And I even look at, listen, as much as I want Joe Biden to win, I still think it's indefensible Donald Trump attacking Nikki Haley's appearance. And it's not even her weight. Like, critiquing her intellect or this or that or the other. Listen, I live in the real world. I have struggled with weight my entire life. I'm comfortable saying words morbidly obese. It's not a criticism of myself. It is a medical term. And I was a morbidly obese woman. And that impacted me in my confidence, in my job. It didn't impact, I never felt like I didn't get a promotion or have a successful career. But I firmly believed that people would not vote for a morbidly obese woman. And also, I wasn't feeling great about myself, and I needed to do that. So I had weight loss surgery in 2015, and it was the greatest thing I ever did for myself. I regret not doing it sooner. And it was part of my path. It was mindful. Like, I'm like, all right, I'm going to run sometime in a couple years. I need to get healthier. I need to lose this weight. And part of it was, and even then, I still had men comment on my weight in 2020. And this was after I'd lost more than 100 pounds, calling me fat, calling me ugly, and it's just, okay, you know, it is what it is. But yeah, so that was something that I did very intentionally, for myself mainly, but also, you know, I didn't want to open myself up to one more level of criticism when I thought running a race was already going to be hard enough. I don't think I share in the book that I had weight loss surgery, but I'm not private about it. I talk.
You mentioned going to therapists and talking about kind of like underlying food issues.
Yes, and
which I thought was interesting about how your childhood caught up with it. And
yes, and so that was happening. You know, if I had weight loss surgery in 2015, the pandemic brought up like a lot of food insecurity issues that I had, and I'm like, I got to eat all the food. There's going to never be any more food. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, weight loss surgery is a tool. It's not a panacea. It's one tool in the box. And so recognizing that something is triggering this, and it was like binge eating. I'm like, what is wrong with you? And that's why I'm like, I got a food issue. And my therapist was like, there might be something more to that. And we talk about it a lot. We've talked about it for a long, long time. It's not something that comes up much anymore in our conversations. But yeah, it's something that definitely was very real for me.
Something else that was interesting, when you were talking about the first time you asked your boss about running for office, like you kind of asked the question and then you informed them and you got these very different responses. I was wondering if you thought you even needed to let them know. I don't know any man that would feel like he was obliged to tell his supervisor what he was doing in his personal life. Do you feel like maybe you kind of gave in a little bit to that, the sexist way of like, well, I need to get permission or inform them and screw it. I'm doing this and you can find out about it when you see my name on the ballot.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. Also, I worked for a small company both times I asked for support. I mean, the company's less than 50 people. And I'm a very, as you can tell in the book, I'm a very open person. I'm authentic. I'm Wendy, whether I'm talking to the president or talking to my neighbor on the street. And so it would have been disingenuous for me not to share that bit about my life, because it would have been such an important part of my life to be running a campaign. I felt like I needed their support more than anything, but it turned into like, hey, are you okay with this? And that's why I'd asked two bosses, and I'm like, I'm not asking another man for permission. I don't ask my husband for permission. I don't need his permission. I informed him. He's like, wait, you're what? I'm like, I'm going to run for office. He's like, okay, do I have to do anything? I'm like, maybe put some signs out. He's like, okay. You know, but then, you know, when I decided in 2020, I'm like, I'm not asking people anymore. I don't need their permission. It is my personal life. I'm going to campaign on my own time, after work. But I felt the need to inform them. And just deal with whatever happens. And you can read about what happened in the book. I felt supported, but when push came to shove, I wasn't sure what would have happened had I actually won with respect to my job security.
Okay, now this question is kind of more of a personal question for me in my running ins with politics. I live in Ohio. It's a red state. It's very Trumpy. You can't escape it. If you want to get involved in politics, you're going to have to mingle with the Republican Party. I don't really buy into the two-party system either. We mentioned that earlier. I would much rather have an independent candidate. What I have found with right-wing politics for women, it is very much who you're willing to sleep with to get the opportunity. I'm curious, since you ran as a Democrat and you mingled around Democrat politicians and the party structure, is it the same on the other side?
So do you mean metaphorically or do you mean literally?
Literally sleep with somebody. Like it's like out in the open. It's very much, I would call it like political prostitution. I mean, it's so obvious.
So I would say that in my experience.
Very weird question.
My experience, that is not part of the Utah culture at all. I could be wrong. But that has not been anything that I have experienced. But remember, I'm an old Illinois Democrat, so that's just not something that I've personally experienced. So, I mean, it's about who you know, right? For sure. And in Utah specifically, I found, this is going to be weird because we have interesting subcultures here, it's about who you're connected to at church and who you're connected to in business. That matters a lot. But I understand where the question is coming from, especially when you look at the prosecutor in Atlanta and the issues that have come up there, assigning the special prosecutor. And I'm like, wait, you did what? Like, you're trying to make a point and Why would you do that? Like, don't do that. I know it plays a role in politics, but I have not, that's not part of the Utah culture, but maybe I'm blind to it.
Okay. Maybe it's Ohio. Maybe it's a red state thing.
It could just be, it doesn't happen in Utah. Like I said, we have an interesting religious subculture where that governs a lot of our morals and behaviors.
I got a big controversial question I want to ask. You don't have to answer if you want to.
Bring it.
You're a political scientist. I want to know. So the question that I'm going to give a little background is the trans movement appropriating women, either purposefully or accidentally, reducing women to outdated, harmful stereotypes. I feel like I'm constantly seeing this play out. I'm fine. People be trans, do whatever you want. It's America. I don't know why people want to stop people's personal lives, but we see it play out in the media constantly. When a man is becoming a woman, it's, oh, I wear pink and everything's glittery and everything's silly and I'm stupid and I'm a bimbo. It's almost as if they're doing some sort of right-wing parody video, like very misogynistic type of undertones. And I think if men said or thought we were like that, we would be outraged. Feminists would be just screaming from the rooftops. How dare you assume that we're buffoons? Do you think that feminists should maybe say, hey, trans women movement, you need to stop portraying becoming a woman as just becoming a moron? Like, it feels like it's setting feminism back a century, if that makes any sense.
Well, my experience has been a little bit different. I happen to know three trans women that I know of, and they're all amazing women. And I haven't seen that kind of behavior at all. These are leaders in the community. They're active in the LGBTQIA plus movement. They're activists. They're up on Capitol Hill in Utah organizing. I just haven't seen that. I've seen our trans population really try to just be accepted for who they are. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but the women that I've interacted with, that's just not been my experience. And again, my circle is limited. I only know a couple of trans folks, but.
I'm kind of talking more national level. A lot of the stuff on TikTok and YouTube, I'm sure you've heard of Dylan Mulvaney, the whole Bud Light controversy that erupted last year. Well, now this activist making these music videos, and it's just really making women look like what they think a woman is.
Almost like a caricature.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, where are all the feminists to say, like, being a woman isn't just being an airheaded bimbo? Like,
yeah,
we're caretakers, we're nurturers, we're mothers, we're leaders, we have moxie, we have tenacity, we run for office, we challenge authority. To me, it just seems as though feminists are really dropping the ball here. And I think it's going to kind of set women back.
I haven't thought about that before. I do think that feminism struggles with intersectionality in general. And what I mean by that is my Black friends or my women of color friends who are feminists are just like, you're not getting me. You're not being the right kind of an ally, right? I think that feminism has a lot of different nuances to it, and that can be challenging. I think, as you know, as a feminist myself, I'm kind of like, let people do what they want to do. But you're right, as we're struggling to be taken seriously for our intellect, for our education, for our business prowess, for our capabilities. We want to make sure that we're, you know, not undermining that for any particular woman with anything that we're doing. But I think I get where you're coming from, but I think an interesting conversation is the intersectionality of feminism in general. That's hard. I know I've offended people. Like, I consider myself a feminist. I'm a white woman of privilege. And I mean, like, I'm not a millionaire. But, you know, I recognize that I'm a white woman of privilege, and am I supporting my Black feminist friends correctly? I don't know. I don't know what the right way to do feminism is. And you're always going to make somebody a little bit angry, but I hear your point. I think it's an interesting talking point. I would love to have my trans friends answer that question. I think that they would have some really insightful comments.
Yeah, I would love to ask, because I feel like the way they're portrayed in the media is different than they live their life every single day, because they just want to get on with their life like the rest of us. But it's a very negative stereotype. I was just wondering, like, nobody's Nobody's brought this up. We'll complain about the Andrew Tates and the Manosphere online saying women shouldn't vote and be submissive. And then we go, well, let's not look over here where they're kind of making women look stupid. Okay. I won't dig anymore. That was a good answer. I'm pretty much out of questions. I think you went through all of them. I think we covered more than your book and all sorts of stuff. Is there any closing remark you want to tell people that are listening why they should pick up your book? Or,
you know, it's interesting. It's not a tell-all book. I hope that people walk away with this knowing, you know, it's a story about my life told through the lens of my campaign. And while there are some interesting bits about that, what I hope people get out of this book is identify power structures, call them out for what they are, and then figure out how to work with them, around them, over them, under them, through them, how to deconstruct them, how to level the playing field. And my goal in this is to say, I did it. I'm just Wendy. You can do this too. And I still have a lot of hope. I still have a lot of hope for politics. I think we're more alike than we are different. And I think that there are things that we can disagree on. And when we're passionate about where those inflection points are, fight like hell for the things that matter to you, right? And try to get people to follow you. But that's what I want. You know, I felt insecure. Like, is my story worth telling? And I've been made to feel insecure. We all have as women. I'm just an average person who's ever gonna want to read my story. I hope that there's some takeaways where people see themselves in my story, whether it's how I honor my heritage and my family, or recognize that my life is just a series of amazing interactions that I've had with people that have guided me along the way. So I see it as a love letter to my community where I'm from, in Illinois, and my community here. And I hope it ends on a hopeful note.
And you mentioned earlier that you take calls from people wanting to run for office. Is there a specific way they could, some woman's listening to this, wants to run and pick your brain?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on Twitter. The easiest way is to go to my website. There's a contact form there. And I think my email is at the bottom. Email is probably the best way to get my attention. But that's WendyDavisUtah.com. Not to be confused with Wendy Davis, Texas. I get that a lot. But Wendy Davis, Utah. And there's a couple of channels. I'm on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. But honestly, the easiest way is to email me. And I'm happy to. I'm taking a call tomorrow from a woman running for Congress who's running into some of these same power structures. So if all I can do is give her a little moral boost, then I've done my job for the day.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed your book.
It was delightful. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. It was great to get to know you a little bit better. Thank you for what you're doing on your podcast. I think what the messages that you're sharing are really important. And thank you for amplifying my voice. I really appreciate it.
For the rest of the story on Wendy Davis's run for Utah House District 45, pick up a copy of her memoir, The Fight You Don't See, available in bookstores everywhere. And to stay up to date on what Wendy is up to next, give her a follow on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Now that you know where we've been, find out where we're going. Tune in to Ladies Love Politics, where you can stay informed without going insane.